Malcolm, it's
Hello.
Stick a Fork in It again.
It is.
4 years doing this stuff
God,
and
4 years.
Breaking out into some new experiences.
New
Tell
territory,
us.
New ground. Oh my God, we're visual. You can see us. We can look at you.
You can see us.
Well, we can't look at you. You can look at us.
Right. And we can see when you look at us.
Exactly.
How
yeah,
about
we're
that?
Watching. How's
yes,
that?
We're watching. So make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube so
Absolutely.
You can know everything that's going on. Yeah. But we're really excited. We've been working on this for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and moving into the Causeway Center
right.
Helped us level up, if
this,
you will.
The whole new studio. I mean, yeah, dedicated. Oh, it's amazing.
It's awesome. And everybody loves coming here.
Yeah.
But an exciting part of it is, mm-hmm. and I think it's a really fun part, and I think folks are going to get to know, we now have a co-host.
Yeah.
Coming in, visit us every once in a while.
Might have heard of him.
Now he is actually, we've made it so his schedule works and he can come in and bring kind of his leadership, but also his humor.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get to know him a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Thomas Mance. I'm
Hi.
So excited
Welcome.
For
Glad
you to
be
our
here.
Co-host.
With my sage age and wisdom. Glad to be here on the podcast.
Well, okay. Yeah. And it's a perfect opportunity to bring up retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sage age. And
so why
I've
would
heard
you bring
you
up retirement
milk.
With my age?
That seems like a suggestion.
I don't understand why that would come
Well,
up.
You did tell me that you had milk delivered to your house, so it took me to black and white films, and it just went from there. So,
mm-hmm.
but you know what? Honestly, I'm close to your age.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't necessarily look it.
Right.
So
I
and
color,
now they can
my
see.
My hair is colored this way as well.
It's very stylish.
How about
my
you?
My hair is not.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Are you close to retirement? Are you thinking about retiring?
No, but I am getting close to that age. So there's a such thing as a back nine. Once you get past 50,
yeah.
right, you start thinking about what those that next thing that you
so
want to
So you
conquer.
Have a barnyard of animals. Is that your retirement of the chickens?
Oh, the
and
barnyard's
the...
getting bigger when mm-hmm. I actually retire.
That's when the cows come in, yeah.
You're not worried about being bored?
You know what? I kind of am a little bit because I had a two-week vacation for the first time in my life. And towards the end of it, I was a little like, what am I supposed to do now?
Right.
You know what? I think I still will use whatever connections or talents I have to help and then just have a little bit more free time in my backyard. I'll probably buy a farm, honestly, and have
I'm
a bigger
walking
place.
Away and I'm never talking to anyone again.
Into the forest.
That is
done.
A lies.
I am
that is a
totally
lie.
Done.
He'll be at the
there
gym.
There is no way.
I'm finished.
No,
I will
not.
Talk to
what
as many humans
do?
In my. I will talk to as many humans in my life as ever want to.
That's fair.
I believe that.
Yeah.
But what is it that you want to do? I'm very interested in that.
This is a concern to those around me. Mostly, what they're concerned about is I will pester them. That's their great concern with my retirement. I've
Probably.
Shared with my daughter at some point that I would like to come and live with her. This now has become her horror.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
You're feeling great, Dad, right?
I'm very good at commenting on things, as some of my colleagues know.
Yeah.
Full-time commenter when you retire.
That's what – there's my job in retirement. I would just like to opine on things
That's
and have people
job.
Listen.
Yeah.
Right.
Where do you get that job?
Well, we're kind of leading that into
– Speaking of retirement.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Big news. Big news for Tampa Bay.
Mm.
Introduce our guest, Thomas.
Yeah, so we have one of the people that I admire most in our community that I think is we say this often. We tend to put up heroes that throw balls or act or – right?
Mm-hmm.
That have certain achievements, have give more money, and all of those things are great. But there are people that have made our community better for their
yeah.
presence in it.
Sure.
They've done thoughtful, hard, committed work. And one of the people that I admire most in our community is getting ready to retire. Let us introduce Tim Marks of Metropolitan Ministries.
Well, that is one wonderful introduction, and I appreciate those kind words. And I feel the same way about you, Thomas. And
but I'm younger. Let's just
no, you are. I mean, and you didn't
years.
Shave today, but you are younger. just to be very clear about that. Yeah, yeah. It seems like it's time, and we'll go deeper into that. But.
Yeah.
I say this to all my employees, that anybody can make a difference in a nonprofit. All of us gathered at yeah. this table have found that out, right? Because mm-hmm. we've come from different careers, and it's like wherever your passion takes you, whatever you're passionate about, the lens on how you see things and your experiences in life, anybody can make a difference in a nonprofit. And I didn't come to Metropolitan Ministries to be a leader. I just wanted to help out, and I found opportunities to make a difference. And I think everybody – you found that journey. Everybody at this table has realized mm-hmm. that. And I encourage anybody that's watching this to figure out how they can make a difference and follow your passions. Because if I can do it, an electrical engineer running yeah. a quote-unquote homeless shelter, mm-hmm. anybody can make a difference.
Yeah, well, we're really excited to have you as our very first video guest, and I've been looking forward to this a lot. As I said, you and I have had a great journey together here in our community, getting to know each other and work alongside each other, but it's a big moment for us to have you come in here as you enter into a big moment in your life.
Absolutely, and it's really funny, too, because even though our regular podcast, that audio podcast is still going to be out there, mm-hmm. folks know the Tim Mark's voice,
yeah,
right? Do. You know the voice. You know exactly who you're talking to. So we're really excited to have you here. But what I want to learn a little bit about you, because your journey to where you are today has a lot of curves, right? It wasn't like, I want to be a CEO of a nonprofit in Tampa. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing. You mentioned Detroit.
Yeah, so I grew up in Detroit. My dad is an immigrant from Yugoslavia, and he didn't have a lot growing up. Like he had nothing growing up. Speaking of farms, he was one of six kids growing up in a farm in the middle of what it used to be called Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. He was a Serbian growing up in a Croatian village. That's not a good thing.
Right.
Right.
His dad immigrated to Windsor, Canada. So he grew up in a single mom environment, much like the clients that we serve.
Mm-hmm.
He did not follow the state religion. So that was like the third strike. So he had a lot of strikes and a lot of things that he had to deal with. But when he finally came to North America, to Canada, he met my mom, who also was of Yugoslavian descent, but was an American citizen at the time. So I grew up in Detroit. He never made it past the eighth grade. He worked in a tool and die plant supplier for the automotive industry. And myself and my two brothers, I was the youngest of three. We grew up in a lower middle class family.
Mm-hmm.
But much like my dad would say, any day in America was better than any day in the old country.
Mm-hmm.
And he found the blessings of what hard work could provide and giving back. And he was a servant leader. And it was those models of him being a servant leader that I adopted growing up, and thought I was going to do one thing, which was, you know, be independent and raise my family a block away from my mom, because, you know, we all would live kind of in the same nuclear family, not too far away. And one thing led to another, and found myself very successful in a corporate career for about 21 years, and then eventually made that switch to nonprofit right after 9/11, when we were living in Boston.
Okay, so you went from Detroit to Boston?
Yeah, so I worked for something that many of your viewers don't know what this is. It's called the phone company.
You mean the books that you used to put onto your kids and
yellow
lift
pages,
up?
Who did you work for?
I worked for Ameritech, which then became SBC.
Yeah, so I worked for – right, so I grew up in the same system. So yeah. I worked for AT&T before they divested.
Same here.
Yeah.
Okay. Same here in that small world.
Wow, that is a very small world.
I worked for Michigan Bell.
Yeah.
My wife worked for Indiana Bell.
Right.
And we met in Lisle, Illinois at this training center. I was in engineering. I was literally using what my degree was. I was designing digital radio networks and then eventually data networks, but mostly internal.
How the heck did you get into that in school? Like, what is there an aptitude test for that? Were you at home taking radios apart? Like, how does a person find out they have that skill set?
Right.
So one is I was terrible in English. I almost failed every English class. But I was pretty good in math.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a vocational school in the city I grew up, which was Royal Oak, a suburb of Detroit. And I went to this vocational program, which focused on electrical circuitry. There wasn't digital technology at the time. It was just coming out. I was learning about transistors and things like that. And I really found myself thriving and growing in this vocational program as opposed to English class.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to go work in the plant because that's what everybody did.
Right.
This is back in 73, 74, 75. Gas embargoes, terrible time to work in the automotive industry. And I had a teacher there that said, you know, you should go to college. You shouldn't go into an hourly job. You really need to go to college. And so that was the guidance that was given. Now, I didn't have any money to go to college,
mm-hmm.
Except working at Denny's and working at other odd jobs throughout the summer. Back then, you could go to college right. by working odd jobs. It's very much a greater challenge for kids today. But bottom line is I stayed at home because I couldn't afford to live in a dorm. And I went to a school called Oakland University, still called Oakland University. And I got an engineering degree from them and worked. My first job was working for Michigan Bell in the data design world.
My dad went to Virginia Tech, I want to say maybe late 50s. Mm-hmm. And his father was a traveling welder. Right. So in the 30s, 40s, he would walk from town to town, be gone from his home for months. Right. Similar story to your yeah. grandparents and your parents. When my dad said that he got a scholarship to Virginia Tech, partial scholarship. My dad told my grandfather he wanted to go to college. My grandfather asked him why. Hmm. What was your father's reaction to you going to college? What was his sense of that for you?
Well, I had two older brothers who went through that same journey and went to college. But again, same type of stuff. Stayed at home, couldn't live in dorms, but were able to go to a local school. He heard the teacher say he needs to go to college, and he listened to that. And he said, yeah, I support that. I want you to do that. He'd worked in the plants all his life, standing up.
And he saw a better life for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was that journey. I remember coming out of college. I thought I was rich. I was making $16,000 a year.
Wow.
You can't hire anybody for $16,000
right.
a year.
But at the time,
they can't
you were
afford yeah, to do anything with
JT Got Rocks.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I could buy a car. that journey for me was such that as we started to divest and become competitive in the marketplace, I found myself moving closer and closer to the customer, and the customer there was GM, EDS, and Ford. Mm-hmm. And to them, everything is a commodity. So you really have to work on relationships to win the business and to maintain the business. And so I found myself moving from internally focused internal data networks and design, but designing networks for the automotive industry, and then eventually moving over to the sales and marketing side. And I grew in that path while my wife started going through the management ranks and rising up. And it was really because of her career. At the time, she was, this is 2000, she was president of the internet division for Southwestern Bell, which owned Ameritech. So it was a big job. Mm-hmm. But she was offered, this is the height of the tech bubble in 2000, she was offered to run a company in Boston. So we moved to Boston, and I was the trailing spouse. Quite attractive, I was, 25 years ago.
She kept you at home, did she?
Yeah.
Come on, let's go.
She wasn't very proud of me. And we had three kids at the time, and we moved from a lakefront home where I would water ski like every morning and have a good time to Boston, to Newton, Massachusetts, right by Heartbreak Hills, where our home was. Beautiful, big home. And we're living there, and it's a totally different lifestyle, and I'm helping the kids get adjusted, and I'm looking at doing some getting into the sales world. And 9/11 shook our entire country. Yeah. Some of the folks watching this weren't alive during 9/11.
Hard to believe,
right.
Yes.
Right. But for us, you know, that went through it, you know, it shook the whole country, but the first two planes left Boston. Well, my wife's investors were up in first class. They were some of the first people that were killed. There were people in my neighborhood. I didn't know them by name, but you knew the homes that were impacted where they were on that plane because they were heading out to the West Coast. In the big tech sector community where we lived, there was a lot of hurt and a lot of pain. And it was that, like, life is short. You don't know what tomorrow is going to bring you. And one of the books I read growing up was Stephen Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Mm-hmm. And that was something like when you used to fly a plane or fly in a plane, you would read a book because there was nothing else to do in the plane but read a book. Right. And so I didn't have a roadmap on how to be successful. I was just working. I thought, oh, this is a book. It's got all the answers. So picked up the book, and the number two habit is to think with the end in mind. And it's like, well, that makes sense, you know, from problem solving, but also from an aspect of life, what's really important in life. And being a person of faith, I took that principle and said, okay, well, what's really important? Is it the big house? Is it the title? What is it? And I could afford to make what might have looked like a risky decision to, like, I'm not going to go back into corporate sales. I'm not going to go back into design work. I'm going to go down to the Boston Rescue Mission and go see them. And I remember going to talk to them and said, I can't case manage. I can't counsel. Their primary focus was addicts. We ran a post-detox program there. I said, I'm not going to ask to get on the payroll, but I'm pretty good with corporate accounts. Maybe I could help raise awareness. And that's where I found out what I said before. Anybody can make a difference in a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. I had run the Boston Marathon in 2003, and we had gotten some – I made an application to John Hancock to get some charity numbers. And instead of selling those numbers – which you could for $5,000 a piece to run the marathon. I took those numbers and I went to some AmeriCorps Vistas and I went to a couple clients and said, how would you like to run the Boston Marathon? We'll cover your costs. There was a gym across the street. You could get trained. Anyways, it ended up becoming a news story. We ended up building a new relationship with New Balance. And I thought, oh, I can do this. This is just storytelling. Matter of fact, this is the easiest sale I've ever made. Like, compared to selling to GM, selling the stories of our clients and who mm-hmm. we serve, well, that's easier than trying to sell technology when everyone's trying to sell technology to the same person. And that's where I found myself making a difference. So then I kind of committed that I was going to do this. And my wife was offered to run a company in Clearwater. So again, the lovely traveling spouse goes down to Tampa and discovers Metropolitan Ministries.
The pretty boy. I want to unpack two things.
Hold that clip.
Yeah. I want to unpack two things. You know, it's interesting how much our – I don't know that I knew how much your and my life paralleled each other. 9/11 was an experience for me as well. I lived and worked in New York City for many years. I was there for the first bombing. And went through that personally. And then the second one, I had just left not too long before that and had friends. And, you know, for all of us of a certain age, you know, it's a seminal moment. You mentioned that that was where you had a life opportunity to say, hey, what is important to me? What about that event resonated with you? Everybody, we could have the story of where were you when you heard. But as you contemplated and went through that, what about that affected you? Was it the folks that you knew that you lost?
Right,
was
the
it
neighborhood?
Right. What sat on you most? You know, how did that come back to you?
It's a combination of things. One is, as you know, growing up in the industries that we grew up in, corporate volunteering was just starting to become a thing, and it was also a way of building culture. And if anybody needed to build culture, the phone company needed to address culture, right? And so I remember those days because our volunteer experiences in the Ameritech community was go to Chicago and then go down to Caprini Green and volunteer. And it was that bonding moments with people that you'd never have these types of conversations with that you would have after volunteering. And I started making that part of my leadership model. So I had a workforce in five states. And I would bring them together at the holidays. And we would go down to Gleaner's Food Bank in Detroit. And we would volunteer and give back. And then we would go out and have a good time. And it was those volunteer experiences that I really felt valuable, that that was a good day. And I'm sure your volunteers feel that. And we work very hard to make sure our volunteers feel that. So it was those experiences of harkening back. When you're part of something bigger than yourself, those are usually good days, right? So there's that aspect of it. But would I ever be caught dead inside a homeless shelter? No. I would give a check, and that's what I wanted to do. It was that moment of what happened at 9/11. The life is short. You just don't know what it's going to bring you. And trying to find purpose in that, 1,000 points of lights, conversations were being had. Like, how can we as a country heal and give back and make a difference instead of staying in the negativity? And the heartache of what we saw, how could we help people in crisis? And all of that kind of came together, if you will, of ingredients to say, well, maybe I should do that.
One last question about this. I'm struck by your dad's sense of responsibility. And is that the moment where you started to understand your sense of responsibility was different?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not from your dad's, meaning the values that you probably grew up with. You started to say there's something different out there.
Yeah. I use the word servant leader, and I don't want to spend too much time on that. But the point is, he modeled that.
That for
I
you.
Mean, he could.
Right.
He did.
It's interesting that that was the moment that
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Even in the plant that he worked in, he was the union president, and he cared about his coworkers, and he wanted to help them out. And so he became a leader there at the church. He was a trustee, but you know, if anybody needed mashed potatoes, he was the guy that would do that, and he would clean the mm-hmm. kitchen, and he did all those hard work, and he modeled what I would mm-hmm. call servant leadership.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I'm just sitting here quietly watching you two because your life paths are so
They are very, very similar, right? You know, the story that I've shared before, but I would just want to share it with you again. So I was living in New York City and very successful, and I had more money than I ever thought I would have. Yeah. I had more success than I ever thought I would have. And I actually literally walked into a therapist's office because I was so lost. Mm. I just had no sense of who I was or where I was. And if you had asked me to define myself, which she did, I was able to tell you my salary, my title, my net worth, but I couldn't tell you anything about what, you know, what about me.
Yep.
And, about 3 months later, I walked into an organization called God's Love We Deliver, who provided nutritious food to homebound AIDS patients. And at the time, I was running all the bank's customer service. And I remember I went in, there's a little volunteer coordinator. Her name was Heather. She's like, now, do you understand how to work phones? I run phone centers across. But she was so earnest and sincere.
Yeah.
And some days I would answer the phone after work, or some days I would go chop vegetables. Right, with a bunch of other people mm-hmm. who never, ever would have come together.
Yeah.
And what it taught me, much like you talked about, is, oh, there's a whole community out here of people who think differently and believe differently and have a different way of defining themselves. And I'm just so happy to hear that from you and happy to share it with you.
I love that story. And you know, for for years, we would meet maybe once a quarter at Panera for coffee,
right.
But we never had this conversation.
No.
Really?
We had conversations about collaboration and okay. making an impact, and I'm excited about where those conversations have led us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have some. So, you know, being out in the community, PR, folks always saw us so separately. We're big, successful organizations. We help a lot of people. But I think the real interesting part is how we've been working together. We just really haven't said a lot about it. And now we're growing that. Can you guys tell us what's going on in our world coming soon? It's already started on how we're working together, because we know that's the best way to be.
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting, for those, the viewers and listeners of this, I think it's an interesting journey that we've been on together. I recall the very first time I met you and coming over to see you. I'd maybe been here about 3 or 4 months, and you all were, in my mind, were and still are the gold standard of nonprofits in our community, and I felt very inferior. I felt like I didn't belong in the room. I felt, you know, that our organization wasn't a partner in a sense that we could bring equal value and capability. And it was a hard thing for me for a long time to figure out how we could maintain our sense of identity, my sense of identity as an organization, in comparison to, again, what we, an organization we thought very, very highly of. And so part of the journey that we have gone on, I think that you and I have gone on in some ways, is understanding how to be friends, and then understanding how to be peers, and understanding how to be collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that those journeys happen easily in the nonprofit world. Right. And I think in our world, it's been a process as well. You would agree, yes?
Yeah, and it's all about leveraging core competencies, which is, I think, back to your business background and back to my business background, opens the door for those types of conversations. And that's the things that we would be talking about over coffee is like, I remember even pitching, like, you know, you guys should be the leader in procuring and bringing mm-hmm. food in and warehousing and storing it. And, you know, we have these other values that we want to mm-hmm. provide, but it, you know, when it comes to alleviating suffering, it usually starts with a meal.
Right.
But doesn't end there. And that's also a like-minded thought that you had as well, is like, well, what's the rest of the journey for Feeding Tampa Bay? And so that has led to these types of conversations about, well, what are our core competencies? What are the Feeding Tampa Bay's mm-hmm. core competencies? And what's best for the community?
Well, and I think, you know, again, throughout this conversation so far, you've mentioned this several times, a lot of it's about building relationship.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you build a relationship, you tend to build trust. And when you build trust, you create opportunity, right? And so for both of us, I think it's been a journey. I think, you know, Shannon, to your question and to Tim's point, one of the things that Tim pointed out and said and shared many times, which is right, is you guys are really good at food. We don't really want to be in the food management business. That's not really our core competency. We, as we understood our mission to shift, meaning we saw that we had an opportunity when someone came to us for food that we were leaving, there. We, you know, someone would come in for food, we wouldn't say anything else other than here's a meal.
Right.
Yeah, we might be the only contact they would ever see, right? You know, in the world of faith, they would say, you may be the only copy of the Bible someone ever sees, right? So we were feeling like, wait, we're turning away that opportunity. We're not doing something about it. That's your core competency. Mm-hmm. How do you start taking that moment and saying to the person, we know you had the lack of a meal today. What we've talked to you about and the partnership about is, well, we'll take on this warehousing for you. You'll help us build broader services, connections and opportunities for neighbors as we move forward, which is really more in y'all's wheelhouse.
Yeah, and it was interesting because we weren't having a lot of conversations where we were maximizing core competencies. And that was every year we found ourselves going a little bit deeper and learning how to best manage food and get it out to the community. And we're still committed to doing the work that we do at the holidays. We're still committed to prepared meals. But once the vision for the Causeway Center started to become a reality, that really, to me, drove the conversation to go to a different level. Like, well, let's get serious. What could we really do together?
Well, and I think, you know, we've always, the evidence of the success of MetMin has always been apparent to many of us. I think maybe for the first time in some ways you saw our vision of what we saw the future might be. And it was really consistent with how you all saw the vision, which I want to veer into that topic a little bit. You know, so you're retiring relatively soon. I don't quite know when that is, but I want to veer into this topic a little bit because I think it's important for folks to understand now your experience in our industry and what you're thinking about. How would you describe the state of the social services industry today? What would be your observation of it, having worked in it now for 20 years?
Well, there's a lot of us out there, right? And it's an interesting balancing act because I love the entrepreneurial spirit of people that see a problem and they want to solve it. But then I also feel like there's opportunities for collaboration and maximizing impact. And I think at times larger nonprofits can maximize impact as long as we don't take our eye off the ball. And if we can support smaller nonprofits, get done what they need to get done, then I think it ends up being a win-win. I don't necessarily see enough of that going on. I do think you all do that with all the number of partners that you get food to and support. It's much more than just the Causeway Center where Feeding Tampa Bay's impact is made in the community. And the same thing for Metro. But I do think that there's an awful lot of nonprofits out there, and it's really up to the donors to decide and be careful when it comes to the return and the stewardship and what's happening. None of us win if there's a nonprofit that doesn't do the right thing. I don't take any pleasure in anybody, being caught doing something wrong because it's a reflection of the industry. And I just think it's important for all of us to be the best we can be and strive to make the biggest impact because it shouldn't be about me or our organization. We should do the best we can. And I just think at the time within our industry, there's just a lot going on in a lot of different directions. I do believe, though, in this community, this Tampa Bay community, that there is a caring spirit for the work that we do that I don't necessarily see in a lot of other communities. And I think that's a testament to the legacy of Morris Hintzman before I got here and also a testament to your organization and what you do each and every day.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you in particular about Morris's impact and influence in your life. And maybe please, for the listener viewer, tell us who Morris was, just so we...
Yeah, so Morris Hintzman was a United Methodist minister who came to Metropolitan Ministries in 1982 for the first 10 years from 72 to 82 was pretty much volunteer run. When he showed up in 82, he changed the trajectory of the organization. Still very much grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, knew what it was like to be hungry, knew what it was like to feed people, and cared deeply about families. And as much as our focus in the 70s was Vietnam vets coming back and feeding them and other single men on the streets, this phenomenon of moms sleeping in their cars started to show up in the 80s, and he wanted to do something about that. And you think about that, back in 1987, we had a shelter for families, and there wasn't a whole lot of that out there. There was single men shelters, there were shelters for addicts, but there was nothing for families. And it was his family focus that kind of put Metro on the map, but it was also his leadership coming out of the church, which has lay leaders and volunteers and engaging the community to make a difference, as opposed to it's all internal. And it was nothing going to be government funded. It was going to be funded by the community. And to do that, the community needed to understand what we were all about. And he worked very hard to engage the community.
As a, you know, again, another person whose legacy, I think we don't really understand the long-term impact because the tentacles of his mission and vision, right? How did it impact you? What lessons, what did it impress upon you that was really important?
Yeah, there's so much, because I come to things with an engineer's mindset and like looking at efficiencies and things like that. Like the first time I saw the holiday tent, I thought, boy, that's a lot of work just to give somebody a food box, right? So I had a better way. Right. And matter of fact, in February of 87, so I showed up at 2006, I showed up at Metro in October. We get right into the holiday season, and there's this big production. I asked, can I meet with a couple clients in February? I want to understand how all this effort really made a difference. And I met Barbara. And Barbara said that we gave her hope. And I thought we gave her a food box and a little onesie. And she told me her story about losing hours and a deadbeat dad. But for that one moment, that day, she was not forgotten. And somebody cared for her. And she had that experience between a volunteer, a food box, and caring for her child, her mom. And I said, oh, that's what this is about. This is not about the commodities. And we say it's about community. It's not commodities. And so it was like, well, I learned that very early on. That's why we do what we do, is to build these relationships. And it really does provide hope for people that don't have a lot of hopeful things in their lives. And so I learned that from him. I also learned about this idea of engaging the community, that it's so critically important that the community understand what we're about. We stay mission and vision focused. He was also big on leadership development. Not a lot of nonprofits focus on that. And so helping us learn to be a better organization, going back to business principles, Pat Lencioni and Jim Collins, and on it goes. We would follow those business principles that were going, being shared in the community. We would take those same principles and apply them to Metro. And that was one of the key principles that Leedy helped us out
with. I think
with.
Sometimes people don't understand the size of businesses we run.
Yeah.
Right. It's always a fun thing to talk about CEO salaries and things of this nature and yada, 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 and efficiencies. But I don't think people understand the complexity and size and scope of what we do. So in your mind, what's the most important thing you achieved at MetMen? Like if somebody had to say, you know, this is what they, you know, I think the body of your work speaks for itself. I'll give you a framework for the answer. Of all the things we've ever done here, our job training program tends to resonate with me most. I think it's one of the things we do best, and it just emotionally I'm drawn to it because I can, you know, what in your mind, what are the things or the thing that you look back at and say, this is something I'll always take with me?
You know, you can look at brick and mortar and you can look at programs, and I think of, you know, in the height of the Great Recession, we have the audacity to say we're going to do it. $25 million campaign. Right? And even, you know, we remember Steve Otto, who was a great author and reporter for the Times. He wrote an article about how crazy this was, but he's going to watch from the sidelines and kind of cheer us on. And, you know, there's no debt on that project, and it's changing people's lives today. And that gave us the courage to expand into Pasco. Now we're expanding into Pinellas. There's those things, but I felt like Okay, so I was the guy that had his foot on the gas and trying to drive entrepreneurship, take calculated risks, because in business you have to, everything's a risk, but you take calculated risks. You don't take risks just for risk's sake. You know, in nonprofits, there's not a lot of good exit strategies, right? So we have to keep moving forward and keeping adding value to the community. It's that culture of being mission-driven. It's about being balanced in our approach, which comes from Collins' good to great. It's being a trauma-informed care organization, which talks about how we care for our staff so that they can care for our clients. It's more the culture impact that I'm most proud of, that when it comes to innovation and, hey, there goes Metro again, as much as I could take a bow for that, it's not me. It's the leaders underneath me that are making the difference and making those decisions. I may help give them guidelines, and I'll help with the board, getting the board on board with where we're going. But I think it's more that you see the good parts of me in your team. There's lots of bad parts of me that I don't want to see.
We don't talk about those, no. Especially not in the podcast.
But what I think is a good thing is, you know, this idea that if the culture's right, I think any CEO can say, oh, that's one of the best things that I ever did, is that it feels like, and it's always a little bit different. It's never as good as you think it is, and it's never as bad as you think it is. But as you can look back and say, we're in the right place. We're growing in the right way. We've got the right people in the right positions. Then you can retire and feel like, okay, you've left it in a good place.
Well, I think Shannon has some retirement questions, but it's interesting. One of the questions I'm often asked is in leadership conversations is, what is the decision that you most regret, or that's most difficult to make? And every single decision that I would cite always had humans attached to it. The decision to change the trajectory of someone's life, to separate, or maybe to hire, but it's always the decisions that you make about the humans that are in your world that weigh on you. Because as you said, successes come and go. Some projects go really well, other projects don't have the trajectory you want or need. But at the end of the day, it tends to be that's what weighs on you, is those. There's still people here that aren't here, or still people that aren't here that I think about, wonder about, hope they're okay. But it's always those kinds of things that weigh on you.
Yeah.
Well, so all of this wonderful growth in this area and nonprofits. We're moving in a really wonderful direction. I've been in a nonprofit for 20 years and seeing people collaborate and you guys at the table. What does retirement have in store for you? You've built a lot with your team. Got it. You've built a lot with your team.
New to the podcast business?
New to these mics.
The headphones help.
I'm new to these mics. Yeah. They're brand new. How are you going to – what are the plans for retirement?
So Will Weatherford was in the holiday tent 2 years ago, and he asked me the same question. I said, I don't know. He said, I'm going to send you a book. And so he sent me a book. It's called Strength to Strength. And it talks about two curves that we have in life. One curve is that success curve where we're getting stuff done. Mm-hmm. And usually early in our career, we're the ones that are getting stuff done and we're very effective. The principle of the book is those that can move from the get it done curve and have to do it all to the other curve, which is more about mentoring, discernment, consulting. If you can get into those types of opportunities, you find purpose and meaning in life, and you can find strength because you have all these experiences that you can build on and you can share your lens and perspective to others. And so it's always been my thought that, much like you were describing, trust me, on a long weekend, I'm on my phone all weekend. I cannot get away from it. And so to think that I'm just going to stop and be happy about it. And grandkids is not a retirement plan.
We're going to touch on that.
When they're
the
not.
The best part is you get to choose. Yeah.
Yeah. But so that's not, that's a part of it, but that is not a plan. And so for me, it's like, I want to find a way to keep finding a way to make an impact. Maybe it's certainly any nonprofit in town that wants some help, I'll be glad to help. I wonder about helping a foundation make good decisions on where they invest their dollars. that might be an opportunity. But I want to be able to help. And I'm not like putting up a shingle for Tim's Consulting.
Right.
But I do feel like that would make sense to me, that I would feel valued to be able to get onto that second curve, provide guidance and support to those who need it, and still find a way to make an impact.
I have an idea. Future business leaders. You guys come from such diverse backgrounds that, I mean, did you ever think in your 20s that you would be leading a nonprofit organization, either one of you?
Mm-mm.
It took that, and for me too, I had to experience something where it's like, wow, you know what, I can help there. I can really make a difference. And that turns that for you. So you heard it here first that there's going to be a conference with both of these fellas talking about it. But grandkids, you have grandkids? We have grandkids. Nobody knows about Thomas. He's going to say talk about it for the first time.
No, I'm not talking about it. You have grandkids?
Yeah, they're staying with me for 2 weeks. My kid's in Italy, and I got a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old.
Oh,
anybody
wow.
wants to come over and help me change diapers tonight, you're welcome. I don't know how many more nuggets we can eat for lunch and breakfast.
Oh, yes, but, chicken nuggets.
Yeah, so no, I have 5 grandkids. I love them all. They're all 5 and under. So I got 2 ones, a 3, a 4, and a 5. And so when we get together, it's crazy time.
Yeah.
But it's fun. And it's like there are those times where it's a great way to decompress from work. Mm-hmm. And then there are times where it's like, this is harder than work.
Yeah.
And, you know, you never see those posted on Facebook. You only see the good times posted. But on so 2 are here and 3 are up in Jersey outside of Philly. And we get to see them, you know, as many times as we can. But, yeah, we love those moments. But, again,
moments.
Grandkids are not a retirement plan. For anybody
no.
watching this, don't make it your only
right.
option.
You know,
same thing is
right.
for golf, too.
Right.
You know, it's and I heard loud and clear what you're talking about and about what you want to do with your life. But have you contemplated the moment, you know, the Monday morning where it's done? That you get up and nobody calls and, you know.
No, I'm avoiding those things.
It's, you know, it's an interesting thing to think, you know, it's particularly if you talk to people that have been as successful as you are, they've, to use a term, they've been lions in their industry, right?
Yes.
And they've been, people have come, you know, come far and wide to seek your counsel and guidance and to understand how you've done what you've done. And then suddenly the phone doesn't ring. Suddenly it's just a different world. It's neither bad nor good, because you and I both know if we've done our job well, there are people behind us that will take whatever we've built and make it even better. I think one of the worst things in our industry is that people that stay on too long for the continued validation of their ego. Right. But for you and I, there's a moment where we're going to walk away. Early on in my career, there was a guy that I was leaving a job going to another, and he gave me this little thing that was a parable about a person that stuck their hand into a bucket of water and you swished it around and you did everything you right. And then the moment you took your hand out of the bucket of water, the water was still again. It never knew your hand was in it.
Mm.
And he said, you know, always remember that. You may think you're very important right now,
right.
but when you leave, the water returns to. Right.
Yeah.
I've often thought of that. And he probably told me that 40 years ago. But it's a moment for you. Right. I was thinking about Judy Leacy not long ago, who was a titanic figure in the arts industry here. And she got on a plane literally the day after she retired and went away for 3 weeks.
Wow.
I think I like that plan.
Right.
There you go. There's a hint.
I might like to do that.
Right. Because she just wanted Ernie. Her husband said, we're going to get you out of here because you have to separate and go find something else. Right. It's a moment. Right.
It isn't. You know, my wife's a CEO and she's got on a national basis, people in like 45 states. And it's like, she's not too far behind me. And it's like, what are we going to do?
Yeah, I was going to ask that question.
What plane are you getting on? And what plane am I getting on? Are we getting on the same plane?
Right.
Well, we haven't figured that one out yet.
Yeah. That's what was my question. Is your wife retiring along with you? But not quite yet.
Not quite yet, but she's on the heels of that. And so she's got those same types of questions. She's got a better plan. She wants to work on corporate boards. I still, like I said, we'll see what doors open and be receptive, but it won't be into the day to day. It'll be, like I said, hopefully it'll be on that consultative side.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this earlier, way ago when you talked about where you lived in Detroit, water skiing, What do you do for fun? What is the? I have a difficult time with fun. It's a question often asked to me, and I would answer often I work because I enjoy what I do. But what do you do for fun? What are the things that pique your interest? Clearly, you're a reader, but what else piques your interest?
So weightlifting, like you,
the gym,
try not to get hurt.
Yeah, I was going to say you don't.
I do it differently than me.
Yeah,
do,
yes.
Yeah. But I do think exercise, as much as I can, is a great way to decompress. Certainly, grandkids are a way to decompress. Mm-hmm. I love sports. I'm kind of a bit of a sports junkie, and that helps. And that's kind of the things that I do on a regular basis.
Well, here's why I asked the question. It might be completely left field, but I'm very intrigued and was going to ask this earlier. How does an electrical engineer become a storyteller? Right. So there's clearly a part of you in your world. I have found over the course of my career that I'm far more interested in art than science. Right. It's just a philosophy. Right. Yeah. I'm far more interested in the human condition. I'm far more interested in the, you know, the visual arts. Right. Is there an artist in you somewhere that you think about? Is there a way to explore that part of your personality that storytelling spoke to?
I am an outlier. I am a geek who likes to tell stories. No, I do think that, that's, I think, why I was successful in sales. It's relational. Mm-hmm. What we do is relational. And I just think you can't be successful in life without being able to tell stories. You know, facts and figures only go so far. So, like, we've got our big event coming up, Bridge Builders. I write every word in the script. Like, why do I do that? And I can't help it, but I do. Right. And that, so that's just been something about it. And so, like, when we figure out, when we go to the community, what stories are we going to tell today with this? You know, and I have my fingers in that all the time. So I don't know. That's
Is there a book in you?
I just don't know. I'm all that interesting. So I don't know about that. But I love your thought process about thinking outside the box, right? Just not just whatever it is, like it's more nonprofit or this or that. But we'll have to figure that out.
So I have one last question I want to ask you. I think Shannon may have one or two, but I we're looking at your shirt. And you've mentioned the word hope earlier, and you know, one of the things you talked about with Barbara that she gave you hope.
Gave her hope.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. I think she also gave you hope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yep.
I like
she
that.
She did.
All right. So what gives you hope now? What do you think about as you reflect on a career, as you reflect on a life of service? What gives you hope? What does it – what are the things – because we certainly live – we live in a world right now that can feel like we're in the middle of a culture war, a political war, that there's a whole lot of reasons to feel like, you know, you want to duck and cover. But that does not seem to be at all your personality. What gives you hope?
It's a great question. So there's one precursor. The reason I wear this Share Hope shirt today is because where I'm at. Because I do feel like the conversations that you and I have had and where our organizations have landed. I got 400 pallets of food here, folks, that we're storing here. And I don't have to pay for my own warehouse anymore.
Right.
And it's this idea, I believe we're sharing hope together collaboratively as an organization. So that's one step that gives me hope. But I also think I said this to my folks last year, and I've said it more than once, people are looking for something to believe in.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what your political belief is, you probably don't believe in the government, right? Some folks don't believe in their religion anymore, but people are looking for something that's real and tangible, something to believe in. And they can come to Feeding Tampa Bay and find something to believe in because food comes in and the food goes out. They can come to Metropolitan Ministries. People come in crisis. They leave moving out self-sufficient. And you see what we do at the holidays. It's real. And so I do think this idea, because we have been through a lot of different crises collectively, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as we've pushed through COVID, as we push through the storms, we keep our head down. And what happens? The community steps up and comes alongside us because they believe in the work that we're doing each and every day. And so that's what gives me hope, is that if I felt like we were doing this and we were on an island and nobody cared, then I would lose hope. But your donors keep supporting you and our donors keep supporting us, and we keep growing and doing more of what we need to do. In spite of all the noise and people trying to split us apart and divide us, There's one place where you don't know the political affiliations of your volunteers when they check in. And I don't either. I don't know their religious beliefs, and I don't care. And so where do you find where that happens each and every day? It happens in the nonprofit space where those kinds of things melt away. And that's where why we have hope, and I know you have it too.
Yeah. If we were smarter, we'd just walk off now.
Yeah, that was a hell of a
I know.
Statement.
That's like the mic drops.
But as it turns out, we're not smarter.
Well, trust me. It's not the first time I've said
those
it,
are,
but I believe
think,
it.
Those are words that are inspirational to us, and I think they're why we admire you. So would you like to ask a question of our guests?
Mm-hmm.
I think you might have gotten this in advance.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a table for four. And you're going to have a meal. We like to say that everything good in life starts around a table and mm-hmm. happens around a table.
Yeah.
Whether it's a conversation like this, whether it's the grandkids and chicken nuggets,
yeah.
right? Everything good in life starts around a table or happens around a table. So you have a table for four, and you're going to have a meal. Who are the three people you invite to your meal, living or dead? Who are the three people you'd like to have at your table?
How much time do I have? if I say why, well, one is Jesus Christ.
Okay.
Our mission says we're an expression of the ongoing ministry of Jesus Christ. I want to gut check that. Hey, this is what we say.
Nice to meet you.
We lead you. Hey, we think that means we should love all, serve all, and give our all.
Right.
Is that, are we on the right?
That's a great first guest.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Somebody really smart like an Einstein or a Newton, just if, like, how do you get to be so smart and what do you think about and how do these things come together? So somebody really, really brilliant like that. A third one is my dad, because we never really had a chance to chat about where I'm at. And some of those conversations from the old country, he kept them kind of to himself because there was a bit of trauma. But I wish I knew more about what that was really like. I try to share that with my kids and my grandkids, and also want to thank him.
How old were you when your dad passed?
It wasn't too long ago. It was just before COVID started when he passed.
It's funny. My mom died when I was 32, and she was the most influential person, and I often lament that she doesn't know who I am today.
Mm-hmm.
I would love for her to understand who I became.
Yeah. Same feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have your table.
Mm-hmm.
We might ask you, what's your meal? What are you going to serve?
Heart healthy.
All right, fair enough.
Sea bass. We're doing sea bass.
Nice. Sea bass, there we go.
What's the one topic you'd bring up?
I think we go back to this, so Christ kind of dominates it. How do we make the world a better place?
Mm.
Another mic drop. Thank you so much, Tim, for taking the time. I've actually enjoyed just being quiet, listening to you two. You're so much alike. You're so much alike that fifth graders dressed up as you and focused on your organizations. And going back to that voice, you sent the video and you could hear his voice in the background. And I was like, that is the craziest thing I've ever seen. So thank you for taking the time. And we wish you the best. And
thank you.
In everything.
Thank you.
The grandkids, the consulting, you have a lot to share. And it's hope and peace as well. So, Ev, you're up.
Yeah, I there were so many great takeaways from this episode. I have books to read from this. But I loved hearing about like servant leadership and community, not commodities. And I'm curious, like, what kind of big takeaways you guys had as well from today's conversation? There was a lot, so...
So for me, I think it was very iconic listening to both of you talk and the parallels of it. And I think it's a wonderful lesson when you think about consulting. Maybe have this guy come in every once in a while because there are people out there who are struggling with who they are and what they want to do in life. And your paths are not the standard. You know, it's learning from people, having influences, and really the core of it all is to make people's lives better. So I think that was something that reinforced something I thought I knew, but now I know for sure.
I would say that I learned, it stuck with me, and it will stick with me, that when Tim said, when I asked her about what we gave her, Barbara said, we gave her hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that'll stick with me. You know, I think as Tim mentioned, there's a whole lot of mechanics behind all of that. But as we know from our work, that moment of human connection – is at the core of what Metmin did and who Tim is. And that was a great affirmation for me.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, and our first episode down with our visual, and we all know how important it is for us to work and collaborate together. It's really how we're going to get things done and, you know, making this world a better place as possible.
Amen, sister.